Broadcasting.
Good afternoon. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue. It's Wednesday, June 2nd. Before we begin our meeting, working down the agenda, quite a few items, could we please have a roll call for
it? Because of their association with it.
Excuse me.
These resources require active stewardship.
Excuse me, Ms. Moretti? Is that you talking? Is that a member of the public? Could you please turn your camera off and mic off? Anyone who's not a member of the committee? Cameras off, please. We'll have cameras on only for committee members until you're called on to testify. While Ms. Moretti works on her technology to turn the camera off, will you please call the roll?
Representative Levy.
Levy present by video and technical difficulties as usual.
Representative Marsh.
Marsh is here by video.
Representative Smith.
Representative Smith is present by video.
Representative Valderrama.
Valderrama present by video.
Vice Chair Pham.
Pham is present by video.
Vice Chair Reschke.
Reschke present by video.
Madam Chair Nathanson.
Nathanson present by video. And this is one more reminder for anyone who is not a committee member, please turn your camera off and your microphone off. When we call on you to testify on a bill, you will turn your camera on and your microphone on at that time. I still see some microphones on that should be off, and I see some cameras on that should be off. The first item on our agenda, by the way, we do have several things on our agenda. We have several work sessions followed by several public hearings and then finally an informational meeting. I plan to do these items in order. The first work session that was printed on the agenda is House Bill 3295. We will carry that over to the next meeting. No work session today on 3295. Again, we're carrying over House Bill 3295. I'm opening a work session now on House Bill 2630. LRO, please remind us about our the bill and our previous meetings about this bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is Dave Beck, Legislative Revenue Office. So on all this, actually, you have dash three amendments. We had dash one and dash two. We had to make some changes. So we have dash three amendments on all this. So what it does is the measure with the dash three amendments prescribes how the state school fund and fund for student success should be distributed to certain school districts impacted by wildfires in 2020. In particular, the measure uses money from the statewide education initiatives account that's within the fund for student success to provide funding stability in the form of a grant to the qualified school districts with a decline in enrollment relative to the 1920 school year due to the wildfires in 2020. The funding in this amended measure will be repealed on July 1, 2025, so it's a limited duration. So to explain a little more about dash three amendments, the measure with the amendments uses set aside money, that's $10 million, from the SEIA, Statewide Education Initiative account, to provide additional funds to qualified wildfire-impacted school districts with a decline in enrollment for the next four school years, starting from 21-22. In fact, the amendment measure leaves unchanged the formula revenue for the state school fund distribution purpose and funding for the SEIA. However, there will be a funding adjustment within the SEIA to accommodate the set aside money in the measure. So in the original measure, actually, the funding utilizes the state school fund itself, formula revenue itself. Now it changed. It uses the money within SEIA account, and it's in the form of a grant. The school districts may apply for this grant. And that's it. There's a set aside money that's capped at $10 million. And on all this, we have fiscal light, by the way, because of the funding adjustment within the SEIA. This is a budget related issue. So LFO would like to see it, Ways and Means. We have fiscal light on all this, and we have a revenue statement also for your review. And that's all I have, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. So on 2630, we have just heard about the Dash 3 amendment. Committee members, any questions for LRO or discussion about this new material that we have? I'm not seeing any hands. Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I would just note, I did have an opportunity to go through the bill in great detail, and I am satisfied that it does what the advocates and me and others had hoped for, which is really to help these school districts that have been so badly hit by wildfire remain stable until July 2025 to give them some opportunity for communities to rebuild and for children to return. So I think the bill does that, and we'll appreciate people's support today.
Thank you. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Beck, I'm just wondering on the grant making or the grant application process, is that with the Oregon Department of Education, or is there another entity that a school or school district has to apply for the grant from?
Vice Chair Reschke, Madam Chair. Yeah, my understanding is ODE will work with school districts. And then there is a small section that describes a rulemaking also.
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I strongly support the piece of legislation in front of us. I think, as Representative Marsh pointed out, it really does get at what the advocates need. Collectively, as a body, we can only take one incident at a time, but I think we ought to recognize we probably are going to have more of these catastrophes in the near future. As I arrived to get online here for this hearing, I realized that Interstate 84 is closed eastbound and westbound, and the Dalles have been asked to evacuate due to wildfire. And so I think it's early, and I think it's about to start. And so I think collectively, we need to lock arm and just do what we can for all of our communities. So I'm really pleased to support this today.
Thank you for your comments and for alerting us to the situation also. Any other questions or comments?
Are you ready for a motion?
I am.
Chair Nathanson, I move the -3 amendment to House Bill 2630.
Vice Chair Reschke moves -3 amendment to House Bill 2630. Is there a discussion on this motion for the amendment? Representative Smith? Maybe not. Okay. Anyone else? Discussion on the amendment. Let's have a roll call vote.
Representative Levy?
Levy votes yes.
Representative Marsh?
Marsh votes yes.
Representative Smith?
That's a strong aye vote.
Representative Valderrama?
Valderrama votes aye.
Vice Chair Pham?
Pham votes aye.
Vice Chair Reschke?
Reschke votes aye.
Madam Chair Nathanson?
Nathanson votes aye. Motion passes. Next motion.
Chair Nathanson, I move House Bill 2630 is amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you. Vice Chair Reschke moves House Bill 2630 is amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Discussion on the main motion here. Roll call vote, please.
Representative Levy?
Levy votes yes.
Representative Marsh?
Marsh votes yes.
Representative Smith?
Representative Smith votes aye.
Representative Valderrama?
Valderrama votes aye.
Vice Chair Pham?
Pham votes aye.
Vice Chair Reschke?
Reschke votes aye.
Madam Chair Nathanson?
Nathanson votes aye. Motion passes. We do not need a carrier for this bill. Thank you, everyone, for your work on this one. I want to especially thank the people who participated in crafting the amendments and coming to a satisfactory resolution of questions and retaining the heart of the bill. Representative Marsh, you had your hand up.
Thank you, Chair. I was Ashley. You took the words right out of my mouth. I wanted to extend thanks to COSA and OEA for really helping us to figure out exactly what we needed in those amendments and for helping us to make the bill as robust as possible for the districts that need it so badly. So many thanks to them.
Thanks for the comments. Anyone else? I'm closing the work session now on House Bill 2630. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2634.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, this is Jamie McGovern. House Bill 2634 is introduced, you might recall, would allow the surviving spouse or disabled heir of an individual in the senior property tax deferral program to continue into that program without having owned the property for the past 5 years, which is normally part of one of the requirements in entry into the program. We discussed in a prior meeting several different senior property tax deferral bills that were up, and then I had a table up of the different types of policies. And so this bill, there's a -2, so it incorporated those policies that were present in the other bills, and I'm just going to list them off. It sets an alternative maximum allowable real market value for properties of $250,000. This is usually impacting areas where there's a low property, medium property value. And it also adjusts the allowable income cap to be in the program by indexing that to inflation. It allows for some late filing, and it has a fee established that's capped in there. And then it entitles the Department of Revenue to a portion of the interest prior to August 15th in the year that the property first became delinquent, if the property is settled by foreclosure or the closing of the estate. And then, of course, this extends the sunset for the senior and disabled property tax deferral program to 2032. The senior and property tax deferral program is not a tax exemption. So there's a minimal revenue impact just from this potential shifting of interest with the sort of split between DOR and the counties in the case of a foreclosure. But that's minimal. Otherwise, there's no tax loss to the local governments with the senior property tax deferral program because the Department of Revenue pays the taxes on the individual's behalf.
Thank you. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. McGovern, could you speak a little bit to the Dash 2 amendment on this bill?
Representative Reschke, the Dash 2 amendment is the different policies that I listed out on top of the allowing the disabled heir to continue in the program without the 5 years and the sunset extension. We had originally thought we might need a different dash to accomplish all those different policies, but they happen to have been included in the Dash 2, starting with the alternative maximum real market value cap.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
Are you ready for a motion?
Yes, I am.
Chair Nathanson, I move the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2634.
Thank you. Vice Chair Reschke moves the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2634. Any discussion? I didn't see any hands so far. Let's have a roll call vote.
Representative Levy.
Levy votes yes.
Representative Marsh.
Marsh votes yes.
Representative Smith.
Representative Smith votes aye.
Representative Valderrama.
Valderrama votes aye.
Vice Chair Pham.
Pham votes aye.
Vice Chair Reschke.
Reschke votes aye.
Madam Chair Nathanson.
Nathanson votes aye. Motion passes. Next motion.
Chair Nathanson, I move House Bill 2634 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Reschke moves House Bill 2634 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a note that I'm a big fan of this program. I'm glad to see it extended and a little bit augmented. It's a self-funding program, which makes it a real neat in the fact that it doesn't cost the county any money up front, and yet we're helping people that need it the most to be able to stay in their homes. So a big fan of that and looking forward to voting aye.
Any other discussion? Roll call vote.
Representative Levy.
Levy votes yes.
Representative Marsh.
Marsh votes yes.
Representative Smith.
Representative Smith votes aye.
Representative Valderrama.
Valderrama votes aye.
Vice Chair Pham.
Pham votes aye.
Vice Chair Reschke.
Reschke votes aye.
Madam Chair Nathanson.
Nathanson votes aye. And did I miss someone trying to get a word in just before we started the roll call vote? Okay, motion passes. Thank you. We assign a carrier for this one, and I believe the carrier should be the chief sponsor, Representative Drazen. Rep Reschke, I'll check with you on that.
That would be great.
Okay, we've assigned the carrier. That concludes the work on this bill, 2634. I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2634. Opening a work session on House Bill 3069A.
Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, this is Caitlin Harger with the Legislative Revenue Office. House Bill 3069A is in front of you today with an A10 amendment. This is establishing the statewide crisis services system via the 988 call line for suicide prevention and behavioral health crises. The dash A10 removes the tax from the introduced version of the bill. It declares an emergency and it defines some parameters related to the operation of that program. There's no revenue impact, and there is a fiscal light, and I believe there is a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means.
Thank you. Are there any questions first for LRO? And if no questions, discussion. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so I'll just point out the dash A11 is identical to the dash A10. The only difference are two lines that put a preemption or prohibition on local governments from taxing this. And I know there's no tax in it right now, but my concern is that we want to have a uniform service across the state. And by not putting this preemption in there, my concern will be that local municipalities or counties might add their own tax to this or surcharge to this, and then you kind of get a patchwork. So we have other preemptions in state tax law, such as traditionally 911 has that kind of preemption, and alcohol taxes has that kind of preemption. So I just thought that this would fit in that with the dash A11. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment. Any other discussion? Representative Levy.
So are you just open for, Chair, for just any questions that could be answered?
Or
because I'm not sure that who I want to direct this to, but so this bill talks about 988 number. And so can you tell me what have other states have done with the 988 number? Do we have other states that have already enacted that, Caitlin? Do you know?
So Chair Nathanson and Rep Levy, I don't know the number of states off the top of my head, but I believe the federal legislation was passed recently to facilitate the statewide programs. And so I think there are states in progress, and I'm happy to get you the number of those states or their names if that would be helpful.
Thank you. I actually have a lot of questions. So am I allowed to just keep asking questions for clarifications?
Well, Representative Levy, we've had a public hearing and we did have a prior work session so that we could get a lot of these questions out. And if there weren't answers, then LRO could have brought them back to us today. Today was going to be a sort of a short, relatively short meeting to just conclude our work on this bill, but let's see.
Actually, I could reword that. I don't have a lot. I have maybe okay. Two more.
Oh, now then please.
To me, they seem like a lot because I never ask very many questions.
Well, yes, please do go ahead. I was picturing, oh, a dozen and
oh,
six
goodness,
o'clock.
No. Oh, goodness, no. So I have a question about cost. Do we have an initial cost of what this is going to be? Because when they testified earlier, I wrote down a website that they talked about, which was the National Suicide Prevention Line and something else. And then I went back and looked, and they talked about fiscal year 2021 through the American Rescue Plan. Says that they have a community mental health block grant program that we could qualify for through this bill, which would give Oregon, this is just specifically Oregon, $22,640,725. I have that right? 22 million, not billion. Sorry, I got too many zeros. And then they have another substance abuse block grant for 16.7 million. And is this incorporated, or could this be incorporated in this bill so that those grants could be made available to people who wanted to use this?
Representative Levy, it's that kind of excellent question that would be handled in the Joint Ways and Means process.
Okay.
Since the last meeting and this one, it's been determined that this bill does need to go to Joint Committee on Ways and Means, so that will be part of a motion.
Okay.
To send it on for someone else to do a much deeper dive on that kind of cost issue.
Thank you. Then that's my only questions.
I'm glad we could cover it today. We don't have the answers, but someone else is going to get the answers.
Well, I know somebody who sits on Ways and Means, so he might be willing to take notes.
Representative Pham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to just express my strong support for us just as a state really addressing this crisis of behavioral health and suicide prevention. I think we really need to be finding innovative ways to support new strategies for suicide prevention and support behavioral health. I also wanted to share that I know Mark Garst during the public hearing that we had testified about concerns about local preemption, and I know my own city, the city of Portland, also has some concerns, which are probably reflected among other cities. They have concerns about local preemption, and I know. You know, we just don't want to, when we think about local control, we want to really make sure that cities have, you know, no one's mandated to do anything, but that they have as much freedom as they can to be able to raise revenue if needed. And I think it's important as a state that we don't predetermine what cities can and cannot do.
Thank you. Any other questions or discussion before we take a motion? Otherwise, it looks like we're ready for a motion.
Madam Chair, hold on one second. I move the -10 amendment to House Bill 3069.
Vice Chair Pham moves the -A10 amendment to House Bill 3069A. Is there discussion? Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll just be voting no on this motion. I prefer the -A11. And so that's the way I will indicate that in my vote. I think local preemption is appropriate here. And so that's my comment.
Thank you for your comment. Any other discussion? Roll call vote.
Representative Levy?
Levy votes no.
Representative Marsh?
Marsh votes aye.
Representative Smith?
Representative Smith votes aye.
Representative Valderrama?
Valderrama votes aye.
Vice Chair Pham?
Pham votes aye.
Vice Chair Reschke?
Reschke votes no.
Madam Chair Nathanson?
Nathanson votes aye. Motion passes.
Chair Nathanson, I move House Bill 3069 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you. Vice Chair Pham moves House Bill 3069A as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Discussion. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of points. I think my colleague, Representative Levy, brought this up, but as I started to dig into this bill a little bit in the 988 service and what Congress passed, they provided a national guideline for behavioral health crisis, a best practices toolkit. And so it's not a prescription, it's rather a description of what you can do to improve your mental health services. And in an 80-page document or so, 988 is only referenced twice, kind of tangentially. So it's the marrying of improving our mental health services and 988 really don't have, they could have a nexus, but they don't really, the guidelines again are a best practices toolkit. And as Representative Levy mentioned, there are some block grants available in the ARPA funding, $22 million for Oregon alone in the community mental health block grant, and then $16 million or so in the substance abuse prevention and treatment block grant program. So when you separate these two out, we currently have a 1-800 number that does suicide prevention, and basically we're just changing the number to 988. And that requires a little bit of technical work and so forth. But if we want to address the mental health issue, and I think we all do, and then the suicide prevention, there's already block grant money available. And so as this goes to Ways and Means, I hope that they would take a look at that as funding for OHA and the things they may want to do, because it's out there for us to take advantage of. Thank you.
Thank you for the comments. Representative Levy.
Well, Representative Reschke took some of my storm away from me. I really believe that mental health is and funding it is really important. One of my dear friends, who's kind of like a relative, he's the brother-in-law of my daughter-in-law, and he's the CEO of Lifeways. And so I talked to him at great length about this bill. And I apologize for not being as engaged on the first time that we went around. That's why I have so many questions now. And he said that they use that the fundamental 90-page thing as a guideline, and it's been being used for quite a while. He also was the one that talked to me about the block grants. He said that he didn't understand why that wasn't something that people were talking about more, about the block grants. So I'm going to be a no on this bill because I think the cost is a lot, and I think that we should flag that for Ways and Means to figure out how they can put those block grants into this.
Representative Reschke.
Thank you. Just a final comment is that I will be supporting the bill to go in Ways and Means, knowing that it does not have the tax on it anymore. But again, want to make sure that we're clear that there is money available for some of the things that OHA wants to do in ARPA funding. And again, we should take advantage of that.
Thank you for the comments. Anyone else? Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I want to echo some of what my colleagues have said in that I think what we have here is a very broadly outlined concept with a whole lot of work that we are going to need to put in before the 988 option is really what we hope it will be, which is to provide a significant intervention for people who need this kind of help. Figuring out, particularly as 988 intersects with other services on the ground, figuring out how to deploy those services, how to fund those services, how we separate and work also in tandem with the other emergency lines, which is a subject that we discussed a little bit in our public hearing. I mean, all of these are big, complicated questions that are going to have to be sorted out within individual communities in order for 988 to really make sense as it as it's deployed within communities. So there's a lot of work ahead, a lot of study, not only on the funding part, but also on the service package and the intersection of the service package with other existing mechanisms. So I think it's critical work, and it is a whole lot of work ahead of us. So first step.
Thank you. Anyone else? Let's have a roll call vote.
Representative Levy?
Levy votes no.
Representative Marsh?
Marsh votes yes.
Representative Smith?
Representative Smith votes aye.
Representative Valderrama?
Valderrama votes aye.
Vice Chair Pham?
Pham votes aye.
Vice Chair Reschke?
Reschke votes aye.
Madam Chair Nathanson?
Nathanson votes aye. Motion passes. This bill is going to Ways and Means. We don't need to assign a carrier. That concludes our work on House Bill 3069A. I'm closing the work session on House Bill 3069A. That completes our work sessions for the day. Thank you, committee, for all of that. Now we're moving to public hearings. First, we have a public hearing on House Bill 2070. So I am opening the public hearing on House Bill 2070. And as LRO gets ready to introduce this topic for us, today's hearing is for the purpose of discussing amendments. And I'd like to make a statement before we begin. Last week, I received an email shortly after our work session on House Bill 2357, which was about a related item. The email letter was regarding statements that were made about the Oregon Forest Resources Institute and persons associated with the Institute. The writer requested that the email letter be posted with that meeting, but it was not possible to post it with that meeting since it was a work session and not a public hearing. The bill we're hearing today includes a funding mechanism for the Institute, and it is related to last week's bill. So I have requested that our committee staff post the email letter to this meeting's materials so that it is publicly available. The email letter has already been distributed to the committee members. So there is some meeting material available for the public now. Legislative Revenue Office, bring us up to date on House Bill 2070.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, House Bill 2070 is a bill that should be familiar. You would see something similar every 2 years where the funding for the Forest Products Harvest Tax is established. Usually it comes in the form of a set of blanks in terms of the rates, where the rates are actually determined in Ways and Means. So that's what you see in the introduced version for House Bill 2070. There's two amendments that we have before us today. Chair Nathanson, would you like me to describe the amendments, or would you like the sponsors to describe the amendments?
I'll ask Representative Marsh, would you like to describe your amendment?
I'm certainly, Madam Chair. Should I do that now?
You know what, Ms. McGovern, I'd like to keep the process like we would for other bills. The amendments happen to be written by a couple of members of the committee, but I would like Legislative Revenue Office to present your just neutral factual explanation, as you always would, about the amendments, and then we'll go ahead and make our statements.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Okay, so the dash one replaces the bill. It removes the sunset for the forest products harvest tax, establishes rates for those four portions of the forest products harvest tax where you would normally see those blanks, and removes the rate setting designation for the Oregon Forest Resources Institute portion by the Board of Directors, and it sets resets the cap for that's OFRI resets the cap for the OFRI portion of the forest products harvest tax, which is to $2020 dollars, which is normally set outside of legislation. And there's a dash two. It also replaces the bill, removing the sunset of the forest products harvest tax and establishes the forest products harvest tax as a single rate. So then the dollars that would be collected and then dispersed to those different segments that already exist under the forest products harvest tax based on the current percentages. And it allows allowable use of funds prioritized for administration of the Forest Practices Act to additional uses, fire suppression, fire mitigation, forest health, and habitat conservation.
Thank you. My plan is to have Representative Marsh explain her amendment and speak first. I will speak next and explain my amendment, and then we will call on the witnesses who have signed up for today. There are eight people signed up for testimony. So Rep. Marsh, you're first.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Colleagues, this is a pretty straightforward proposal found in amendment number one. I have been frustrated with the way that we administer the harvest tax currently. I don't think it provides much in the way of stability, predictability, or transparency. So what I propose to do is very simple, is to leave the base funds exactly as they are, and to simply make the taxing rates that are associated with each permanent and subject to a COLA. So the bill doesn't change anything about what's funded. It leaves the tax rates stable at their most current level, and it simply makes them permanent. And again, the concept here is that I believe that members of the public and those who are paying these taxes need to be able to see how those tax rates are calculated, and they need to be able to budget in and predict what the tax rates are going to be and what the impact of those taxes will be on their operations. So very simply, amendment number one leaves everything intact but makes the current tax rates permanent, subject to increase from a COLA in future years.
Thank you, Rep. Marsh. Drafting in behind Representative Marsh, I wrote an amendment that is based on some of the same concept, which is to have a permanent rate, but takes a little bit different tack. As I reviewed it, even though it's very popularly understood that there is a harvest tax, the forest products harvest tax is comprised of five distinct rates. And currently that information is provided by three different entities to help inform Legislative Fiscal Office how to get the rates established. Four of the rates are adjusted statutorily by the legislature every 2 years. So in my amendment, it establishes a rate without the two-year sunset situation that we have currently, But in addition to that, instead of setting the five separate rates, this amendment establishes a single rate. The purpose is to make the process more transparent and add dependability for budgeting and for taxpayers. The main features are that I am retaining some of the key features of the existing harvest tax, which is excluding the first 25,000 board feet and directing the revenue to the existing programs. And it, in fact, directs the revenue to those programs in the proportion that they receive them now. And I have posted some testimony in the area where you would find public testimony. I've posted a comparison of the current House Bill 2070 and the -1 amendment and the -2 amendment. It's kind of a concise way to look at it. And I've also posted a little chart, a line graph, that shows the rates over the past few years, so you can see what they've been and whether the fluctuations were small or large over time. So that's the end of my testimony. Now it's time to hear from the public who, yes, Rep. Reschke, we'll call on you and then we'll call on the other witnesses.
Sure. I just want to thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering if we could ask a few questions of LRO or if you'd want us to wait till after the public testimony to do so.
I think it's fine.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, Ms. McGovern, I think it's in the -2 amendment. There is a, it says that the tax increases by CPI, the Consumer Price Index. And I'm just curious if we have any other tax like that where we increase it by CPI, or I know we use CPI for other things, but I'm just wondering about a tax if that's something that is normally done.
Thank you, Vice Chair Reschke and Chair Nathanson. So yes, the index to inflation is in both the -1 and then -2. And you're right, there are other things like brackets. And I think we just saw in the senior deferral bill that there was an increase in income index to inflation. But actual taxes on dollars, I'm not a personal income tax expert. That's Kyle, but I'm not aware of any of those sorts. Yeah.
Thank you.
Other questions, Rep. Reschke, or shall we go to our witnesses now?
Let's go to the witnesses, and I'll have some comments, I think, afterwards. Thank you.
I will announce the witnesses, and as you speak, remember to turn your camera on and your microphone. And especially given the late hour, we always appreciate it when our witnesses can keep their comments to about 3 minutes each. The first will be Roger Beyer, followed by Jody Weiser.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer, and I'm here representing Oregon Small Woodlands Association. Since we've already testified on this bill and the original version of it, I will keep my comments based on the -1 and the -2 amendments. OSWA is opposed to both the -1 and the -2 amendments as drafted, and both the proponents of the amendments have stated that they want to make the process more transparent, add dependability for budgeting and for taxpayers. And I would maintain that the current system is much more transparent than either of these amendments, because these amendments both have the rates of these taxes being increased by a CPI or a COLA, which no one knows what it is or what it's going to be or how it's calculated in the public. But having a public hearing every 2 years on the rate is much more public and transparent than these COLAs would be. So that is point number one. I would also state that for purposes of dependability for budgeting, The current system allows the rate to be changed every 2 years to match the budget for these different programs, combined with the ending fund balance. The budget can then be set so that the budget writers can be relatively certain that these programs will be funded for the next 2 years based on the projections of the harvest and the ending fund balance in the program. Under these amendments, either of these amendments, if the COLA is small and the harvest level is also small, there's a very good chance that the budget levels won't be met in the program and therefore have a budget problem sometime in the next 2 years. Also, for transparency for the taxpayers, that it's the same that under the current system, the taxpayer has an opportunity to put input into the programs that they want to fund and make sure those programs are funded. Therefore, we feel that the current system is much more transparent in both budgeting and taxpayers. And also, the 3/5 vote requirement under the current system also requires that a broad support of from both parties, typically, before the tax can be passed, therefore ensuring more transparency, more dependability for both budgeting and for taxpayers. And I'd also like to point out that the current, one of the proponents suggested that the ratepayers need to know in advance what the rate's going to be. The tax is set by the calendar, not for the fiscal year. Therefore, ratepayers know at least 6 months in advance of any harvest at the start of the biennium, and that lasts for 2 years. Therefore, ratepayers know well in advance what the rate will be and can plan for it when they're planning their harvest. So for these reasons, Oregon Small Woodlands Association is opposed to both the -1 and the -2 amendments, and we would support sending the bill with blanks into the Ways and Means Committee, where it can be married up with the budget and be passed as it normally does on other sessions. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Beyer.
Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, my name is Jody Weiser, and I'm pleased to be testifying for Tax Fairness Oregon. As you're probably not surprised, Mr. Beyer and I don't agree on this idea. We actually like both of the amendments. We prefer the -2. We think that it's rather crazy that for generations now, we've been every 2 years forcing the legislatures to deal with this small tax that collects only $15 million or so a year. We don't every year look at any other tax that I'm aware of. We don't look at the personal or corporate income, gas, beer, wine, or marijuana tax rates every biennium. And I can't see that there's really any reason for us to do that for this tax, except that there are some caps in law so that they have to be manipulated. But that manipulation doesn't make any particular sense. If the tax were based on value rather than volume, there would be no need to index the tax. But if you look at the chart in the first chart in my testimony or on Chair Nathanson's page, you can see that some of the taxes have barely moved at all over the last 10 years. And yet, of course, the cost of delivering services have gone up significantly over the last 10 years. And the value of wood has gone up significantly over that same period of time. Yet the amount of money for most of the services has basically not changed. In our testimony in April, we made several recommendations, and Nathanson's amendment accomplishes 3 of them. It removes a provision requiring the legislature to reset these rates every 2 years. It has an increase for inflation annually, and it removes the cap that says the harvest tax will never be more than 40% of the funding for the Forest Practices Act. These changes will remove from your agendas the setting of rates for a tax that collects very little, really, and will allow legislators to focus on more important work. The other elements of the of our preference for the dash two over the dash one is that it immediately, as of next year, increases the rate by about 10%. So that would be 10% more than it was when it was set 2 years ago. So it's, you know, that's quite a lag time, and a 10% increase does not seem terribly significant. We think that the percentage is, rather than five different tax rates, would be simpler to manage. It takes care of all five ways that the money is currently dispersed, and it removes that artificial cap on funding for the Forest Practices Act administration. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you. Next, we will hear from Mike Barsotti. That will be followed by Tyler Ernst, and then Josie Kerner.
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Pham and Reschke, and members of the committee. My name is Mike Barsotti. I'm a family forest landowner in the Lyons area and a member of Oregon Small Woodlands Association. As Roger has stated, OSWA opposes the amendments and believe that the House Bill 2070 should be moved as is. The funding between the agencies receiving the harvest tax dollars fall completely independent of each other, and they're not closely related to the cost of living. For example, the private forest accord, formerly referred to as the MOU between the environmental and landowner communities, may increase the Department of Forestry's need for field foresters. If this happens, there will be a significant increased cost from the harvest tax to fund these additional positions. Another example, the Forest Land Protection Fund has been stable for years because the cap on how much of that fund could be used for wildfire has been stable. But if that cap changes because of the cost of wildfires, then that amount for the protection fund will need to increase, independent of how the others increase or decrease. The annual harvest tax volume and ending balance vary by year and require unique adjustments. They're not uniform across the different agencies that use this fund. Again, the changes are not related to the cost of living. Automatic cost of living increases will not deal with the unique conditions for each of these organizations. And finally, the taxpayers, this harvest tax dollars are forest landowner money. And this bill does not have a way of refunding excess funds if needed. So thank you for the opportunity to speak in opposition to this bill, and please reject the amendments of 2070. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Barsotti, for your comments. Next was Tyler Ernst.
Yes, good evening, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Reschke and Pham, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tyler Ernst, and I serve as Policy Counsel for the Oregon Forest and Industries Council, a trade association representing the majority of the state's large private forest landowners and forest product manufacturers. I am testifying this evening on behalf of OFIC and our member companies in opposition to the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2070. First, with regard to the Dash 1 amendment, this committee has now heard from multiple sources why the harvest tax rate is structured as it is to be reauthorized biennially, given that it is dependent on a number of highly variable factors, chief among them, of course, being the annual timber harvest volume from private lands against which the tax is assessed. It has been suggested that the annual harvest volume is relatively flat, that this isn't actually a highly variable factor, but this is patently untrue.
I would point you to the Earth Economics Report that was commissioned by the legislature and presented to the Ways and Means Committee last month, which reported harvest volumes in the state over the past 10 years. In those years alone, harvest volumes have ranged from 3.1 to over 4 billion board feet. Now, how a nearly 1 billion board foot variation can be characterized as immaterial is frankly beyond me. In fact, over the last four biennia, the biennial harvest volume has varied by an average of over 8% and over 6% year over year. This variability is illustrated in a chart that I submitted for the record if you would like to see it presented graphically. When you layer on top of this the variable cost to the department in administering the Forest Practices Act, the resultant variation in the assessment rate needed to be that is needed to fund the 40% landowner portion of the Forest Practices Act administration is incredibly significant. The average percent change in the Forest Practices Program portion of the harvest tax over the last four biennia has been 27%. Making the harvest tax permanent and pegging it to an inflationary adjustment simply won't do when input volumes and costs are this variable. The Dash 2 amendment is even more problematic. Not only does it remove the necessary biennial recalculation of the harvest tax rate, but it removes the cap on the portion of the Forest Practices Act enforcement costs that are borne by the forest products industry, kicking any surplus into a broad and vaguely defined slush fund. And this fund shift is being proposed for an industry that, according to a recent Ernst & Young study, which I referenced in a presentation to this committee back in April, is already paying an aggregate effective tax rate that is 1.5 times the average rate paid by businesses in the state. Not only is this fund shift inequitable, but it risks eroding the credibility of the state's Forest Practices Program by making the industry disproportionately responsible for funding its own regulatory program. No other private sector protects vast public resources like air, water, carbon storage, and wildlife habitat to the extent of the forest sector. It is appropriate that the general fund bear a greater portion of the cost to implement that protection. Now, I urge this, as I said earlier, I urge this committee not to adopt the Dash 1 or the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2070 and to allow the typical rate adjustment process to play out once the department's budget has been finalized. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Ernst, and I appreciate your wrapping up when you heard the timer. Thank you. Next is Josie Kerner, followed by Amanda Astor, then Brenda Gilmer, then Trisha Steen.
Chair Nathanson, members of the House Committee, for the record, my name is Josie Kerner, testifying for the League of Women Voters. I report on forestry issues, and I also serve as revenue coordinator. One of the League's priorities for the 2021 session is to generate adequate revenue for essential services while promoting equity and progressivity in tax policy based on the ability to pay and to be equitable, adequate, stable, easy to administer, and simple as possible. HB 2070 in its original form continues the tradition of requiring the Oregon legislature to approve the forest harvest tax every 2 years. The League of Women Voters believes that any tax bill should not have to be reinstated every biennium, and we do not understand why this tax is an exception. The bill proposed by Rep. Marsh 2389 and Rep. Nathanson 2430 at the start of the session proposed to end the tax review every 2 years, and we supported that idea in previous testimony. Rep. Marsh's Dash 1 amendment to this bill ends the 2-year sunset, uses the current rates and ties those rates going forward to inflation, and we support this simple, efficient change. It's a modest increase. The 2-2 amendment to HB 2070 distributes the tax revenue proportionally to the same entities as the current tax, harvest tax, with a little more for the Oregon Department of Forestry by removing the 40% cap for the administration and monitoring of the Forest Practices Act. So their share can be then used for other purposes, such as fire suppression, fire mitigation, forest health, and habitat conservation. Instead of a complex set of individual rate settings procedures dependent on budgets, the amendment sets one harvest tax rate at approximately $4.53. It's now $4.13. And going forward, it also will be indexed to inflation, to the Western States Consumer Price Index. Both amendments preserve the first 25,000 board feet exclusion from the tax. Chair Nathanson's Dash 2 makes the rate setting process simple and transparent by streamlining the harvest tax with sensible modifications that will be far easier and less costly to administer, and is supported by our league's position on tax policy. In the long term, we need a better system of timber taxation, one based on harvest value rather than volume, one that would not tax the family forest and smaller woodland owners onerously, and one that would certainly not cripple the timber industry, but would bring in as much timber revenue as our neighboring Western timber states. Washington collects more than twice as much as Oregon does by using timber value, whether measured by ponder stumpage value. So changing over to a value tax system would bring in significantly more revenue for Oregon and be more equitable in comparison to our neighboring timber states. For now, we ask you to amend and pass HB 2070 with the Dash 1 or the Dash 2 amendment. Thank you for this opportunity to discuss this legislation.
And thank you all for wrapping up our testimony. Next is Amanda Astor.
Good evening, Chair Nathanson and committee members. For the record, my name is Amanda Astor. I'm here on behalf of the Associated Oregon Loggers as their forest policy manager. AOL is a statewide trade association and voice of Oregon's forest operators, whom are an integral part of the entire forest products supply chain, and many of which are payers of the forest products harvest tax. The Forest Products Harvest Tax funds many critical aspects of wildfire suppression, as well as forest management, monitoring, science, and education, which you've heard today. And it's only levied upon those who harvest timber in the state, which goes to provide Oregonians necessary climate smart and renewable forest commodities. The legislative intent of the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments is noble. And as a process-oriented thinker myself, I too am always searching for more efficient processes and business practices. Regrettably, the Dash 1, which eliminates the sunset, and the Dash 2, which sets a permanent rate that is tied to inflation, does not achieve the intended outcome. Due to fluctuations in harvest volume year to year, there will inevitably be years where the affected organizations and programs are overfunded and years where they are underfunded. The Dash 2 does take care of the overfunded years by creating a slush fund, but there is no solution for those underfunded years. This means the purpose of adding dependability for budgeting taxpayers will not be achieved. I highly suggest reviewing the graph that OFIC provided and was mentioned in Tyler's testimony. I would also add that salvage operations, disruptions in harvest rotations, and continued fires will add to budget uncertainty year to year if the Dash 1 and Dash 2 are approved. Forest businesses, operators, and forest professionals do not only pay the forest products harvest tax, but they also provide in-kind resources during fire season to protect all Oregonians and help keep our forests and communities healthy and prosperous. Another key component of the Dash 2 is removing the required 20% ratepayer, 60% public admin pro rate fee split. This is the only way for AOL's members' in-kind firefighting contributions to be acknowledged by the state. In conversations with ODF and fire protection districts, AOL's members and all forest operators are often and vigorously thanked for our actions each and every year, playing an integral role in the state's ability to aggressively attack wildfires, save lives, and protect communities. AOL is strongly opposed to the Dash 1 and Dash 2 changes to the forest products harvest tax as described in House Bill 2070. Please remember that you have heard now from the three organizations that represent the lion's share of the taxpayers for this tax, and we all do not support the Dash 1 nor the Dash 2 amendments. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I am available for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Astor. Next is Brenda Gilmer.
Chair Nathanson and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you about this bill. I'm a resident of Florence, Oregon. I am a volunteer with Tax Fairness Oregon, but I'm speaking from on my own behalf. I'm a retired tax lawyer, and I spent 12 years with the Montana Department of Revenue and was intimately acquainted with every way you can impose tax, collect tax, structure tax. And I would like to bring that to the table because I think it matters. You could not imagine a more complex system for taxing anything, activity, product, or company than what you have put together for Oregon's tax, timber tax system. You just couldn't, nor could you build a system that it was more, opens more invitation to lobbying. I bet you spent way more money on lobbying than you spent, than this tax will literally raise in a biennial or just one tax year. Substantively, this bill would create a simplification. It would create a stream of income, a simplified stream of income from an industry and disperse it much like it is now. So revenue, much like it is now, disbursements, much like it is now, and relieve, give you a chance to take back, sit back, start doing some serious research about what has been presented to you by timber lobbyists and decide how to make this simple. You have to make it simpler. If you don't make it simple, you're spending gross amounts of money on administration. That's just wasted time. I'm glad that the Ernst & Young report was raised because I found it to be a fraudulent document. And that's not fair to say. Tax Fairness did do a paper going through, based on what we know of the paper, of the snippets that were publicly presented about the Ernst & Young report. There's mismatched income, mismatched tax years, assumptions that are not clarified. If the standard for SEC reporting is that, for misstatements, is that you not affirmatively misstate something or you don't omit something, a material statement that would make that what you said misleading. And I posit that that report was intended and does in fact mislead. And I would ask each of you who have some relationship, you must have some relationship with an accountant you trust, try to get a copy of the real report, get a copy of Tax Fairness Oregon's criticism, take the two, trusted professional, and say, is this true?
Ms. Gilmer, I'm sorry, but you may not have been able to hear it, but the timer went off.
Okay, I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
So we would welcome you to submit any remaining testimony. In fact, anyone who's part of this public hearing today, you are welcome to submit your written comments to us. You have 24 hours from when today's meeting started at 5:30 until tomorrow afternoon at 5:30. Please send us your comments if you couldn't, if you had something you didn't get to say today. We welcome that.
Thank you.
Next is Trygve Steen.
Hello.
Hello, I can hear you.
Okay, I don't know what happened to the camera. Do I see myself or not?
Well, we see you just fine.
Well, that's great. Thank you. And thank you, Chair Nathanson and committee, for this opportunity to provide some input on this really very important matter. I appreciate both amendments. I have a preference for -2 because of the modest rate increase and particularly because of its shift of support to increase support for the Oregon Department of Forestry for which we can really anticipate increased costs as we are working on modifying how the Forest Practices Act is working here in Oregon. I heard a earlier objection to shifts in harvest volume and costs, but I think in that sense, this tax works because as harvest goes up and costs go up, the tax intake from this tax will help cover those naturally increasing costs. At this point, I think it's really, I find it really important to try to express my disappointment in the fact that in this whole area of taxation for the timber industry, we're missing the opportunity to have the timber industry more directly support the localities on which it is inflicting costs. And so the lack of having timber tax revenues support local economies and governments is still there. And this is a change that was made a number of years ago, and we've still not rectified it. I'm also concerned that we're missing an opportunity to use taxation in the timber industry to encourage better forest practices, particularly longer rotation forestry, so older trees are logged and our forests are operated in a more sustainable way. I saw those features in earlier bills, and I would encourage you to try to add those in any future iteration of this legislation. So thank you for your attention. And again, I appreciate your effort to simplify this process and support what you're doing with Dash 2.
Thank you, Mr. Steen. And for the record, in your own voice, would you please state your name for the record?
I'm sorry. I could have been more appropriate there. And you actually marvelously accurately pronounced my name. I'm pleasantly surprised. I am Trigby Steen, and actually I'm a retired professor of environmental science who has taught courses in sustainability since 1970. And also courses in forest ecology and management.
Thank you for that. I want to confirm with our committee staff that that completes the witnesses signed up for today's public hearing.
Yes, it does, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Committee, I'm going to close the public hearing now. I do see a hand go up from Rep. Reschke, and before I close the hearing, we'll hear from Rep. Reschke, and I do want to let you all know that we have three more bills to hear and a short informational meeting. I hope you can stay with us for a little while. We don't have a lot of more public testimony, but I think we could complete it today if it goes pretty smoothly. Representative Reschke.
Thank you. I heard that as be quick, Rep. Reschke, and I'll try to do that. So just in the testimony we heard and from the advocates of the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments, I hear the refrain predictability, stability, transparency for the purposes of budgeting and taxpayers. And so my thinking is that the taxpayers in this case aren't the general public. They're the ones opposing the Dash 1 and Dash 2. They're the forest industry. If the Dash 1 and Dash 2 are more transparent or predictable or stable, I would think that the forest industry would be for these amendments, not against them. Second is we have this process, this legislative process every 2 years. I think the legislative process is probably one of our best opportunities and chances to be transparent with said taxes. And if we're not, then something's wrong with our legislative process. I'm not suggesting that. I'm suggesting the counter. My observation also is that those who are supporting the amendments are mostly folks outside the industry, not folks inside, or at, not folks that actually own forest land or work the industry. And my final comment will be that the comparison to Washington or other states, while it may be true that other states reap more in the forest taxes, that doesn't mean that you have to compare apples to apples, and that's not an apples to apples comparison, because there are other taxes in Washington that companies don't pay that they do in Oregon, such as the corporate excise tax. So you have to take all the taxes into consideration from a business, not just the forest harvest tax, and compare that. You have to compare all the taxes, and then you can make an apples to apples comparison. Thank you.
Thank you, Rep. Reschke. I think I'll respond in just a few seconds to one point about transparency. When the bills come to the Revenue Committee on the annual two-year cycle, they always come with a blank in them, and there isn't significant or, material participation in the public hearing in the rate setting process. Rates are added after the bill leaves Revenue Committee, it usually just in the last 2 or 3 weeks of a legislative session as part of a budget process. So when I talked about, I don't want to speak for others, but when I talk about transparency, that was part of what went into my analysis. But thank you for your comments. So now I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2070. And I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2456. We have two witnesses signed up for that bill. We have one witness signed up for 2438 and three for 2447. If everyone can stay with us a little bit past 7 o'clock, I think we can conclude our business. Mr. Alanak, is that all right if we go a little over 7 o'clock?
Yes, it is, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. So, committee, I hope you can stay with us for these public hearings. And again, we hope that you can hold your comments for those testifying to 3 minutes each. And Legislative Revenue Office, we'll appreciate a brief introduction to each bill. So open the public hearing for House Bill 2456.
Hey, good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yes, House Bill 2456, the committee heard this back in late January, the 28th of January, the early part of the session. And 2456 is an omnibus measure that contains a number of tax provisions, modifications to tax provisions. And this bill originally came about in, or many pieces of this bill came about in the 2020 legislative session as well as part of Senate Bill 1531. So 2456, we do have the dash two amendment. I would draw your attention that in OLIS, there is a document that has the section contents. So it goes section by section and explains what are the modifications in each section. And for the dash two amendment, there's only a couple that I would highlight that are different from the dash one amendment, the things that weren't in the dash one amendment that now are in the dash two. The first is section one, and that's just an Internal Revenue Code connection point update. It's just one we missed. It wasn't in your vanilla reconnect. It's included here. There's some slight wording changes to tighten up some of the language in some of the other sections. And then the only one that's really a new proposal is in section 21 through 24, titled Manufactured Dwelling Part Gain. And that's related to an existing income tax subtraction, encouraging mobile home parks. In this case, these would be ones that were destroyed by the wildfires last year, encouraging them through a capital gains subtraction, or potential subtraction of capital gains, to be sold to a housing authority or a nonprofit organization. So again, other than that, most of the changes are similar to what you've seen in the dash one amendment.
Thank you. Committee members, any questions for Mr. Easton on this omnibus bill? Rep. Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Easton, I see that you have posted, I just wanted to make it known to the committee that he has posted, or LRO has posted, section contents to House Bill 2456-1 that lists by section what's being changed and what's being tightened up. So it's a real helpful document, at least for me, to see all the pieces moving.
Rep. Pham.
Yes, I just wanted to make a brief comment. This is clearly an omnibus bill, but I remembered something from this bill back in January when we were talking about this environmentally sensitive logging equipment, and it was such a complex. We had someone from the executive vice president from the Association of Oregon Loggers explained that in order to define what environmentally sensitive meant, it became so complicated that they just went with the age criteria. So in 1999, they determined that any equipment that was less than 8 years old at the time is considered environmentally sensitive. And so they kept it to any logging equipment that was originally manufactured after 1992. But I just wanted to recognize that that has changed. You know, that static age has meant that now it's going on 30 years now. 40 is that, oh my gosh. So it's, yes, I just wanted to flag that, but not raising any concerns about this. It's not enough to block it, but I did want to raise that concern.
Thank you, Rep. Pham. Okay, I'm going to go to our witnesses now. Signed up for 2456, we have Eric Knoll, followed by Allison McIntosh. And as always, we appreciate your keeping your comments brief since we're running late, but we do want to hear from you.
Good evening, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Reschke and Pham, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eric Knoll of the City of Portland. Given the late hour, I will just restate our support for two parts of the Dash 2 amendment that are also included in the base bill of House Bill 2456, and then primarily make myself available if there are any questions about these two pieces. First, Sections 9 through 10 include a narrow expansion of the Holte statute. The Holte is a local option property tax exemption supporting homeownership for low and moderate income families. The change in Section 10 will allow a city to extend eligibility on projects for up to 24 months on a case-by-case basis if progress is being made with construction. And second, Sections 18 through 20 provide the necessary authorization for the City of Portland Revenue Division to request federal background checks of their employees from the Oregon State Police. For the city to comply with IRS guidelines, OSP must conduct these criminal background checks for our employees, specifically in the revenue division. Thank you for your time this evening. And again, I'm available to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Knoll. Allison McIntosh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Reschke, Vice Chair Pham, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Allison McIntosh. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Housing Alliance to express our support for the provisions related to affordable housing included in the Dash 2 amendments and the base bill. Again, I know you're busy and it's late, so I will be very brief. I'm happy to answer questions, and I've submitted more lengthy written testimony. For the Dash 2 amendments, Sections 2 through 6 impact local option affordable housing property tax exemptions. Local option property tax exemptions are one tool that a local jurisdiction can use to help incentivize and make financially viable affordable housing developments in their community. And the legislature has authorized several of these, including the two that are being adjusted in the Dash 2 amendments. The proposed changes align these exemptions with recently revised federal guidelines and flexibility for the low-income housing tax credit. The newly adopted federal policy allows affordable housing developers to serve people with slightly higher incomes, up to 80% of the area median income, if the property also serves people with lower incomes and the average income remains at 60% of the area median income. The impact of this change will mean that developers will be able to serve people with lower incomes more easily, and aligning definitions will help us ensure that we're not creating a patchwork of different laws or flexibility. Happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Ms. McIntosh. Committee members, any follow-up questions before we close this public hearing? on 2456. Rep. Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did have a question for LRO, if I could. And that is to Section 24, specifically the corporate excise tax, and I think Mr. Easton's chart there. And I'm just, I haven't looked at it in specific, but just kind of curious. It just kind of seemed like something. I know this is an omnibus, but I'm just trying to drill in a little bit more what the rationale and what's going on in that section, if I get a quick clarification. And I can get one offline as well if we want to go into more detail.
Yes, Representative Reschke, so we do have, there's a corporate excise tax, just an Internal Revenue Code cross-reference, that's in Section 16, and then Section 24 is making the change related to the manufactured part capital gain, and that's really, and that can be picked up on both the personal income tax side or the corporate income tax side, so that would be making that adjustment to that subtraction in both of the chapters of ORS relevant to those two taxes.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. I'm closing the public hearing now on House Bill 2456, opening a public hearing on House Bill 2438.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. To be as concise as possible, House Bill 2438 is one of the placeholder bills for the committee. This particular one deals with a study for property tax. It's a relating to property tax bill. There is a dash two that, and I don't, all of this is tied to the informational meeting that you'll be hearing in a few minutes from Representative Smith. The contents of the dash two are House Bill 3033. And I can leave it right there, Madam Chair, because I don't want to steal any of Representative Smith's thunder in a few minutes.
Okay, thank you. So for House Bill 2438, does anyone have any other questions for Mr. Allenack? Or can we just move right now to the witness who's signed up to testify? Good, let's have public testimony. Mr. Sean Cleave.
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Pham, Vice Chair Reschke, it's a pleasure to see you in what I hope is one of the last times I get to testify in front of your committee. I do want to applaud you on an exceptionally well-run committee, Madam Chair, and the comments from your membership has been exceptionally bipartisan and pushing the ball forward on good policy from my perspective. Madam Chair, I am a little interested in Representative Smith's testimony regarding the incorporation of 3033. I do not have bill numbers memorized this session, Madam Chair. I will just say that for the record, again, Sean Cleave testifying in a neutral position to the bill, just pointing out that the Taxpayers Association of Oregon would be interested in participating in any efforts to modify our property tax system in Oregon. Obviously, there are some unique mechanisms that have evolved over some time. And I think that the challenge, especially for me, to align the politics with the policy of moving forward with something that is exceptionally difficult from a political perspective is something that we and I would like to participate in. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll wrap up my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Cleave. I want to check with the committee assistant again. There was no one else signed up to testify on this bill. Is that correct?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any committee, any other comments or questions before I close the public hearing on 2438? I'll wait just 5 or 6 seconds here. Okay, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2438. We're in the home stretch. One more hearing and then an informational meeting. I'm opening the public hearing on House Bill 2447.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, I'm so sorry about my filtered light. It's a sunny day. House Bill 2447 would simply extend the sunset for the historic property to July 1st, 2028. We're not considering amendments. We don't have any here on the schedule today. So it's an extension of the historic property program, which is a special assessment program. I don't know if you want me to. Okay, great.
That's good. We have a few witnesses signed up. We have three names. I'll let you know the order of them now. Peggy Moretti, Chrissy Curran, and Mark Garst. First, but I apologize. Committee, do you have any questions for Ms. McGovern or comments before we go to our witnesses? Okay, Ms. Moretti.
Good evening, and thank you for your fortitude here, and appreciate the opportunity to speak. I'm Peggy Moretti. I am here representing Restore Oregon. Restore Oregon is a statewide nonprofit comprised of thousands of Oregonians working together to preserve, reuse, and pass forward the places that embody our diverse heritage. We urge your support of House Bill 2447 and the renewal of Oregon's Special Assessment Program. Historic places are irreplaceable assets to Oregon, and no one is making more of them. Preservation drives the rebirth of rural main streets, employs highly skilled artisans and craftspeople, shelters low-income individuals in affordable housing projects, and measurably responds to the climate crises through adaptive reuse. These resources require active stewardship or they will be lost to future generations. Oregon's Land Use Goal 5 mandates this stewardship, but the state currently provides very little to enable it. While most states offer a historic rehabilitation tax credit, the only state incentive offered by Oregon is this special assessment program, a 10-year freeze on the assessed property value to ease the tax burden while owners invest substantially in roof replacements, new foundations, utility systems, seismic retrofitting, code upgrades, and the restoration of historic masonry, windows, woodwork, and other architectural features. Not a giveaway. Enrolling in special assessment requires a verifiable long-term commitment on the part of participants. It requires designating a structure on the National Register and following through with a robust conservation plan. Although special assessment offsets a mere fragment of the total investment, it can make or break a project's economic viability and must be continued until such time as a more impactful incentive can be developed. We're aware there may be some amendments coming forward that clean up certain technical aspects of the bill, which we support. And Restore Oregon also concurs that special assessment is not the perfect tool for single-family residential properties, especially as we strive to channel resources to underserved communities battling displacement, who might be better served by a grant or other means. But we believe residential properties should remain eligible for special assessment until a better incentive is developed and passed. We urge the legislature to prioritize, in fact, and mandate an analysis of the needs of historic residential and commercial small town property owners in Oregon based on robust outreach and collaboration by various community interest holders, with the goal of recommending a new slate of rehabilitation incentives that will effectively leverage the potential for restoration and reuse to achieve our shared goals of equity and accessibility, economic development, retention of cultural heritage, and reduction of CO2 emissions. This consultation with stakeholders has not yet occurred, largely due to the pandemic. Restore Oregon would be honored to partner with the state in this endeavor. And in the meantime, please do pass House Bill 2447. Thank you very much.
Thank you for staying with us and providing the testimony tonight.
My pleasure.
Next is Chrissy Curran.
Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Pham, Vice Chair Reschke, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chrissy Curran. I'm a Deputy Director of Oregon Parks and Recreation in charge of heritage programs there. I will be brief. Oregon Parks and Recreation Department supports House Bill 2447 that extends until 2028 the sunset date for Oregon's only state-level historic preservation benefit, the Special Assessment for Historic Properties Program. The program currently sets to sunset in 2022 if this bill is not passed. We've already sort of gone over the basics of this program. It is administered by the State Historic Preservation Office, which resides within Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. You may remember we talked to you about the program back in March and showed you some pictures of some special assessment projects across the state. We also described the mechanics of the program at that point, so I wasn't planning to go into any detail there tonight. While we fully support House Bill 2447, we are proposing a few changes that will make the program more responsive and more accessible to Oregon's historic property owners. These changes are consistent with the language in Senate Bill 108, which is currently stalled in the Senate. The proposed amendments make several administrative adjustments, but I will focus today on the biggest changes that would be part of an amendment. One, it would limit participation to owners of income-producing properties only. It would eliminate the limit of two 10-year terms. Instead, owners may use the program as often as they have qualified work to do. Terms would remain 10 years long, and property's maximum assessed value would continue to get reset between terms. Improvements to seismic upgrades, energy conservation, and universal access would be encouraged but not required. And importantly, it would extend the sunset date of the program to 2028. Again, we fully support House Bill 2447 as written. We just think this is a good opportunity to help the program reach its full potential. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And last is Mark Garst.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Mark Garst with the League of Oregon Cities. The League also supports extending the sunset, but we would ask that you consider amendments to House Bill 2447 along the lines of what you heard from the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. Senate Bill 108 is the vehicle that they have that kind of lays out these changes. It does three things. It extends the sunset, limits the program to commercial property, and allows commercial properties to re-enroll in the program after their 10-year terms expire. The LOC supports these changes to the program. We've heard issues over the years about including residential properties in this program. Probably first and foremost, the Constitution requires that when you come out of a special assessment or exemption, that your property is, the MAB is reset. And often taxpayers will go into this program and not understand that long-term consequence on their property taxes when they enter the program. Additionally, we think that there may be an equality issue here. We've heard that there is a strong perception that this program really only benefits wealthy homeowners because they are the folks that are more likely to have the 10% of real market value to invest in a property that would allow them to access the program. So there are two other amendments that we would ask that you consider. First, we would like to tighten up the definition of commercial property that you see in Senate Bill 108. As was discussed, it says that property is held for the production of income. This would include single family homes that are, or condominiums that are held for long or short term rentals. We would ask that the language be amended a little bit just to say that commercial property does not include single family residential or condominium properties. We think that if these properties held for owner use shouldn't be included, then they probably shouldn't be included as rentals. We want multifamily properties to be included in the, to be able to access the program. And if we just narrowed it that way, we think that they would still qualify. One other amendment that I would ask you to consider. It has just come to our understanding today, actually, that the Historic Property Special Assessment Program has a big issue. And that is that currently properties, when they enter this program, are getting a double benefit from Measure 50. And if you look at ORS 308-5051, it says that the assessor will first set the specially assessed value to equal the assessed value of the property at the time of application. This language has been around since 1991, before Measure 50 was ever in place. And at that time, they had changed it from true cash value to assessed value. And true cash value was just a term that they used to use that was similar to real market value. And at that time, the two values were effectively the same. The assessed value was the real market value. Now with Measure 50, this means that the property would have a specially assessed value set at a reduction that reflects their Measure 50 benefit. It goes on to say in two that you then take that specially assessed value, again, which is the assessed value, and you do apply a ratio of the maximum assessed value the property would have had if the property were not specially assessed over the real market value of the property. So you are effectively giving it that adjustment twice that it would get from Measure 50. And we don't think that that was the intent of the program. We've always heard that the benefit of the special assessment program is that you not pay taxes on the improvements that you're making over the 10-year period, never that you would get a double benefit from Measure 50. I'm happy to discuss these amendments with you at any time, and I really appreciate your time tonight and for sticking with it.
And thank you, too, for staying with us. For everyone who's testified on this bill, Ms. Moretti, Ms. Curran, Mr. Garst, I encourage you to take advantage of the opportunity to submit written comments to either reiterate what you said, or in the case of Ms. Curran and Mr. Garst, since you're recommending that the committee consider amendments, I hope that you would consider giving us written comments explaining that, because we're happy to read them. You can submit it for the public record up to 24 hours after the meeting started. Committee members, any questions? Rep. Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question would be for Mr. Garst, just to kind of clarify something on his commercial property definition to not include single family or residential property. So some historic properties are like a market with a living space for one family up above. Would that be included or not included in your definition?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Reschke, we could certainly look at that. I would consider that property to be a mixed-use property, and so my inclination is not that it would be excluded from my definition necessarily, but I think that Legislative Council would be the ones to really ask about that, and they can make sure that we get it right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rep. Reschke, for bringing that to our attention. Any other comments? Okay, I'm closing 4-5 the public hearing on House Bill 2447. And last, we have an informational meeting on a program. Mr. Alanak, do you want to introduce this for us? Or do we go right to Rep. Smith?
In the interest of time, I think you're good to go right to Representative Smith.
Then, Representative Smith, I invite you to tell us about this program.
Wonderful. Thank you, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Greg Smith. I represent District 57, which includes the rural frontier counties of Sherman and Gillam and Morrow, parts of Wasco and parts of Umatilla County. Gang, one of the major issues in Frontier Oregon is how do we build a home, a single home, in a county like Wheeler that has a population of approximately 1,450 people? It's very challenging to make this occur. And so a group of citizens, including Representative Owens and Rep. Levy and the good senator from Vail, we came together along with our county commissioners and our city councils and some of our school board folks and came up with the concept of everyone gives a little. The big issue in these frontier counties is the cost of construction does not keep up with the appraised value, or the appraised value doesn't keep up with the cost of construction, excuse me. So if a home costs $200,000 to construct, its appraisal is only coming in at $180,000.
And so you've got this gap of approximately $20,000. And so we've created a program in the smallest counties that basically does this. If a county or city has a buildable lot that's zoned residential, and if they're willing to donate it to the construction of a new home, perhaps it's a tax foreclosed property or they received it from some other means, but if they're willing to donate it, the county or the city, and if the city is willing to waive hookup fees, and the electric co-op, because in our neck of the woods, we operate with co-ops, if they're willing to waive hookup fees, and if the local school district is willing to collaborate with CTE opportunities for their students, whether that means holding a hammer or perhaps working on the design of the home or perhaps helping to sell the home. There's so many different facets that go into the construction and sale of a home. But if they'll collaborate, if all those pieces come together, the Port of Morrow has agreed to finance the construction of these homes at 0% interest and to hold the loans and carry them until the home is sold. What our intention is to then, and this is based upon the Hermiston School District model, is to then take the home, open it up for an open house for a few weeks, and then put it up for auction with the goal of having middle-income folks, perhaps maybe a teacher or someone who works in the, you know, in the hospital or somebody who works in the public works department, to bid on the home. We'd put a cap on that to make sure that this is not done for wealthy individuals, or we already have within our program. And we would then sell the home, take the proceeds, revolve it into the next home. And the goal in the small counties of Harney County and Grant County and Wallowa County and Wheeler and Gillam and Morrow is to see if we can get a revolving home program in which we construct one home a year. That's the goal on this. There is an income limitation. Originally, I selected $125,000 for an individual and $250,000 for a couple. And many folks scratched their head and said, why'd you come up with that number? Well, Rep. Nathanson, or Chair Nathanson, will recall back in 2009 when we passed the personal income tax increase, that was actually the threshold that the legislature used to define wealthy in Oregon. Since then, I've had a chance to visit with the Oregon Education Association, and their thoughts were, why couldn't we reduce that down to $75,000 for an individual and $150,000 for a couple? And for purposes of rural frontier Oregon, that works just great. Now the question is, well, what do you need House Bill 3033 for? Well, there's two reasons. It's one thing to be able to try and build a home. It's another thing to try and recruit folks to come out to Frontier Oregon and to take a teaching job or to take a job as a nurse in a clinic in Spray, Oregon with 240 people or to come to, pick the town. And so what we're trying to do is create this integrated system in which we could help build our housing stock, create incentive, serve those key industries that are desperately in need of recruitment and see, you know, if we can all give a little. The concept is everyone gives a little to try and make this happen. And so what I'm asking folks to do is to help me with this concept. I would ask that we put a 6-year sunset on it, that we do an income limitation of $75,000 for individuals, $150,000 for couples, and we see how this plays out. One key point I want to point out is there's a opt-out and an opt-in feature. So if the counties and cities said, you know what, we don't want to do this, then they don't have to. On the other hand, if the counties and cities said, we'd like to do this, but you know what, public safety is really important to us, and so we're not going to give the property tax exemption because we want to make sure emergency services is fully funded, then they can do that as well. And so it's at their discretion. And the last point I'd make, Madam Chair, two last quick points. One, gang, this revenue is not coming into the state right now. And so if we can be successful, we can create an opportunity where we build housing stock, induce professionals out to Frontier, Oregon, and in a couple of years, put some more kids in our schools and put a house on the property tax rolls in these Frontier areas. Gang, I'd close with this. It's not very often you can get the cities and the counties to come together on a property tax measure. Both the cities and counties have supported this concept and are willing to testify in support. And with the amendments I shared with you, I'm pleased to say that the Oregon Education Association will also support this concept. And can't you just imagine if those taxpayer folks and Mr. Cleave and Lori Wimmer can all come together, man, we can call this session a success. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Smith, for presenting. Everyone gives a little.
Everyone gives a little.
Thank you. Committee members, any questions for Representative Smith? Rep. Pham.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say I appreciate Rep. Smith's creativity in bringing this forward, as well as the flexibility to kind of lower. I also had some concerns about the income thresholds, and I appreciate the flexibility of making sure that we're really targeting middle income, you know, workforce teachers and public service workers. So, I like it.
Any other questions or comments? Okay, I am closing. Oh, Rep. Marsh, your turn.
Thank you, Chair. Rep. Smith, did you say, maybe I missed it, what happens when the individuals sell the home?
Yes, so the goal of that is to create a revolving housing fund in mm-hmm. which be able to take a portion of the proceeds over the cost of construction and put that into their next home. The cities or counties can put it into the next home. And the way the Hermiston High School model has worked is after about six homes being built, they develop enough cash to where they don't have to use the borrowed money, but they can cash flow the projects with cash.
I was thinking more the individuals so someone buys this home, and then is the home available to be sold at full market value when that person leaves?
Yes. But the goal on that, Rep. Marsh, and that gets a little challenging. Mm-hmm. Our goal is to really focus on middle income folks in middle income neighborhoods who are there to take middle income jobs. Should something happen in the future where, you know, Phil Knight decides to move back to Fossil, there's nothing I could, you know, we couldn't figure out the language on how to stop that. But that's mm-hmm. not the intent of this. And I really believe if we do this the way we're talking about, I think what you're going to find is perpetually nurses and teachers and folks who work for the Forest Service are going to be the ones that are purchasing these homes. And let me just add to that really quick. Rep. Marsh, our intention on these homes, the Oregon Home Builders donated a floor plan. Our goal is a 3-bedroom, 2-bath, kitchen, living room, single car garage. Mm-hmm. And so those are the homes we're going to be building. They're starter homes. They're starter homes for folks who haven't had an opportunity to get into a home yet to get into them.
Thank you.
Representative Levy.
I would just add on to what Rep. Smith is saying is that the belief is that because they're starter homes, they're not going to be real anxious to move out for a number of years. So, and they'll be adding to our communities. That's why we think it's a good bill.
Madam Chair, thank you. And any support we can received to move this forward would be greatly, greatly appreciated.
Noted. And there was a reference to House Bill 3033. That is not a bill that we'll be hearing because we don't actually have that bill, but it's possible to incorporate this concept into another bill that we had a hearing on which is the one that Mr. Alanak said he didn't have a lot to say about it.
Thank you. Thank you again.
All right. Another slow count to five. I don't see any more hands. All right, I am now closing the informational meeting. Mr. Alanak, anything else for us before we adjourn for the night?
No, Madam Chair. Well, I guess just a reminder that tomorrow night, the 5:30 meeting, you will be meeting again, but as part of the Joint Committee on Tax Expenditures, as opposed to the House Revenue Committee.
Okay.
Do we get extra credit for tonight?
No, but maybe we should each wear a different hat.
Yeah.
Thank you all. We're adjourned.